Well, hey, cousins, you were listening to Revolutionary Hood Rap with Kim Young of Dope Black Social Worker, and not just welcome back, I'm back. Ooh! I have been down bad, but we will get to that. We will get to that. First and foremost, there's no guest this week because it is a special episode. It is the one-year anniversary of Revolutionary Hood Rap, right? Like, enter the applause. I'll do it myself since I have no budget for audio engineering to put that clip in there yet. And I am thrilled to have made it 1 year on this mic doing this thing. I had no idea what it would turn into. I had no idea how it would change me. I had no idea how I would be able to connect with folks across the globe, right? Not just here in the continental US, but across the globe. And so shout out to all the cousins who have been rocking with me from the beginning, those who I have picked up along the way, people who cheer for me, champion me, support me in ways that I do not know and do not see or do not hear. I really appreciate it all. I feel felt, and I certainly feel lifted up by all the care and love and just compassion that is, and protection that is sent my way. And so let's go ahead and jump into this anniversary episode with some revolutionary news. And it's me. I am the revolutionary news this week because I am celebrating me. I'm celebrating me. Not only the podcast rocking for a whole year, but like the things that I have been able to contribute by operating in my purpose, right? Like I don't take any of it lightly. I don't take it for granted, but I've also been incredibly reflective and moving into just this greater place of accepting all the things and all the spaces that I fill up, all the people that I'm able to pour into, the folks that I'm able to educate, reach, inspire, affirm, make laugh, feel seen, all of that. And it's really interesting, because there are probably folks in my life that saw this for me that I never saw, but they knew that some of this, or maybe they didn't see it quite like this, but I believe that they knew that I would have some level of impact and reach that was greater than I ever was going to give myself credit for or be comfortable enough to admit that I'm actually doing it. And so I am my own revolutionary news for the week by simply being who I am. And by being who I am, I know for a fact that I have allowed other people to be who they are. And that is really, really cool. Really, really cool, y'all. Really cool. Dope as fuck. So let's do a little bit of Earth is Ghetto, because we have not done the segment of Earth is Ghetto in a month of Sundays, because we have had some phenomenal interviews. Some phenomenal cousins have joined me on the podcast to share their stories and share their wisdom and their gems with us. But I just feel like we got to get caught up, because ghetto thing after ghetto thing has just been occurring. The most ghettoest of all, I was sick. Y'all, I was down bad for a whole week, to the point I had to ask my mom, I had to call my mama and say, girl, when was the last time I've been sick? Because what I don't be is sick. I don't catch colds. I don't get down bad. I don't end up on the sick and shut in list, but I got shut down last week and I received it, right? I was on my sofa so much for 7 days, sleeping and watching all the things. When I tell you I watched so much television, I watched so much shit to the point where like, I don't even know what there is to watch anymore. What I watched that has been on my mind since I saw it was The Black Widower. Cause y'all know how I feel about true crime documentaries and scammers and grifters and white mess. And so The Black Widower came across, I was on HBO Max, which is like not even the name anymore. Cause then people went and changed the name to Max, drop HBO, dumb. Anyways, I was on the HBO Max app and Black Widower popped up and I was like, ooh, what is this? And it's this story, I think it's three-part true crime docuseries about Thomas Randolph. and his wives that mysteriously just dead, gone up out of here. Y'all, Thomas Randolph, and just take a moment, Google him. Because when you see his picture, you're going to be like, oh, yeah, Brett did it. He did it. But Thomas Randolph was married six times, and four of his wives just dead, gone, up out of here. Two, if I'm not mistaken, he was accused of actually killing himself. One, he was acquitted on, and the other, he was found guilty, and he's currently locked up. And Thomas Randolph has been living this life that he kind of, sex, drugs, and rock and roll from the 60s and 70s and 80s and so on, picking up women at strip clubs and, picking up women at shit, probably bake sales and Tupperware exchange parties. He didn't really care where he got a woman from. All he saw was a lick. Thomas was just trying to figure out how he was going to make his next check. When I tell you, buddy racked up over $1 million in life insurance policies. He would meet these women in like newspaper ads. Back in the day, I guess you would send your information to a newspaper, end up on like a dating page in the newspaper, and then people would get the newspaper and look for people they wanted to date. He was finding women like that. Like these poor ladies had been divorced or their husbands had died and they was just looking for love. And then here come Thomas ass 3 weeks into relationship talking about some, hey, I really think you should consider getting life insurance and putting me as the primary benefactor on your life insurance policy. These women was doing that shit and then just ended up dead. I don't mean to laugh. I'm not laughing at like them dying. I'm laughing at like the what of it all? Because how this makes sense? And not even just that, it's like the themes of just generations of women being conditioned to want love and marriage, and they take it in any shape or form or package, it arrives to their front door, then they end up in a tremendous amount of bullshit or dead. Like, you would think after all of these years of just observing and watching, we would get these lessons a lot sooner in life. But I even got women in my own generation caught up in this bullshit of fantasizing and being conditioned for like wanting to be in love and married and end up with people who are just like scamming them, changing them for who they are, them not really knowing who they are. So they're trying to figure out who they are in these relationships. And they end up in these situations that are just like, huh? So the whole time I'm watching The Black Widower, I'm sitting there like, huh? How is any of this making sense? How y'all letting this man with this mullet and a 37-inch bust down convince you that you need to take out a life insurance policy and put this joker as the primary benefactor, and you don't even know this man. And then all of a sudden, when you just start getting sick, or he start bringing people around, and he's trying to hire folks to like go kill his wives, I said, this is nuts, nutty. But I was locked in all the way through, and that man was trying to defend his innocence. And still, even to this day, he's like, oh, no, I didn't do it. Because, he read up a couple law books, plus he's a white man. So, they know, they believe they know everything. And the law, ain't got shit to do with them because they created these rules. So when the rule book come down on their ass, they don't know what to do. And so Thomas then read all these law books and he think he know the law better than the court know the law, and he keeps trying to find these loopholes, and they end up he did end up getting a retrial though, but then they was like, nah, bro, you extra guilty, so you got to go away. And if I'm not mistaken, I think they even gave him the little death penalty, I think, if I'm not mistaken, because he in Arizona or Nevada, he in one of them West Coast South states, because Arizona, that's like the Alabama of the West Coast anyway. I think he in Arizona. No, he in Nevada. It don't matter. He in one of them states, that man locked up. He ain't coming back out, and he killed them women. And so if you're looking for a nice little true crime situation to distract yourself from all the foolishness that is occurring in the world, I highly recommend Black Widower on HBO Max, because we don't refer to Max as Max. We call Max HBO Max. You know what else was on that? Was on HBO Max. It was this another docuseries on called Teen Torture Inc. And it's kind of been in the vein of like those, I think there's like two other docu-series about just these reform camps for troubled youth back in the 80s and the 90s and the early 2000s. And so Teen Torture Inc. Was also on there. And I went ahead and gave that one a watch because they had Bad Baddie on the cover. Y'all remember Bad Baddie? Like, Catch Me Outside. That little white girl that was on, well, the little white girl cosplaying Black American culture, who was on Dr. Phil and told them people, catch me outside. She got sent to one of the ranches that Dr. Phil would continuously work with when he would have the caricatures of young people who were just struggling to be seen and heard and felt and validated and loved and cared for. So they got labeled troubled. And they would end up becoming entertainment for America. But he would send a lot of these kids to like these ranches where they would essentially just not care for young people, use fear as a way to get them to comply, not have any type of treatment or behavioral health, mental health, substance misuse support, none of it. And so it was just kind of followed these stories of young people who had just went to these different type of camps and programs since the 70s. And how a lot of these institutions were like deeply rooted in evangelical systems and structures, because we know how big the evangelical movement and church is in this country. Like, them jokers control a lot of shit. And they have been controlling a lot of these reform camps and troubled youth programs since like the 50s and the 60s. And they still operate many of these camps and institutions today in places like Utah, deep parts of the South as well. And as I was watching Teen Torture Inc., it made me think about my time of like how I got introduced into this field and into this work. I started working in a residential treatment facility for young people. And I got introduced to the work as these young people were considered severely emotionally disturbed. And I come to find out like that term is just an evolution of this troubled teen movement from the 80s and the 90s and the 2000s, as well as like these institutions and even the one that I was working with were just subsets of a lot of these breakout camps and programs that would just take young people, either placed there by their guardians or placed there by the systems or placed there by the courts. And they would just be in these places, not getting the treatment and the care that they require and they deserve. And in many ways, just adults imposing their power and using fear to try to get young people to comply, which we know that shit don't work at all. But as I was watching the Teen Torture Inc. docuseries, it just really made me think about like young Kim not even knowing the role I was playing in that bullshit when I worked at that particular treatment center for that year that I first got out of undergrad. That was a transformative experience. And I saw this work and also saw young people through a lens that was necessary for me to get that lesson so young in life. And so young in my career. But I will say, we continue just to have adults out here bringing kids into the world that should have never brought kids into the world, right? Either they weren't prepared for the kids, they wanted kids because they had a void they were trying to fill through another person, or they just kind of conditioned to believe that was a thing to do. So they just end up bringing young people or bringing life into the world that they shouldn't have done it. And I will always stand 10 toes down in the belief like every child deserve a parent, but all these parents out here don't deserve the kids they got. And that's just true. There are some parents and caregivers and guardians that have a supreme role of rearing, guiding, protecting, and loving young people that cannot fulfill that role. Don't have the skills to do it, the desire to do it. They don't want to do it at all. They don't like young people. They don't like the young people in their households or their families. And they're just out here, right? Like in the realm and the sphere of young people fucking kids' lives up. And that's just the truth. One of the biggest things that we got to continue to say out loud and accept is just how much adults are just shitty. Adults make living incredibly difficult. Adults make living incredibly exhaustive. Adults make living harder than it needs to be. And they just generally and genuinely appeared as a lack compassion and understanding for young people, forgetting that they were young at some point in their life. And so we just need more adults, right, to like stand in a place of defending, caring, loving, protecting young people, regardless of blood affiliation, community attachment, or connection, because they just need us. They deserve us. Kids, they deserve good adults, and we need to be better adults. Don't be shitty. Don't make life harder for them than it has to be. Don't end up as a subject on another docuseries 10 years from now on, like Teen Torture Inc. Part Two, and they got your ass front and center, picture nice and big, talking about how you fucked their life up. So we can turn this ship around the moment we decide that young people are worthy of just being who they are, autonomous beings, deserving of guidance, but also the freedom to fail as many times as necessary without like the system come and crush on them and destroy their future and lives, adults come in and crush on them and take away their light and their joy. Young people deserve to fail as many times as necessary to get these lessons. And failing doesn't always lead to death. And death is typically like that motivating factor that activates the fear in adults to then impose their will over young people. But young people need the grace in the room to mess up and the belief they're going to be okay if that happens. And we have a responsibility to give them those soft places to land and mess up. You see what happens when social workers just be trying to detach, even though they're sick? And watch just mindless television. And it's kind of difficult to be mindless with a topic like that. Another topic that is also difficult to be mindless about or try to ignore is like we can't shy away. I cannot shy away from the news of Joe Biden dropping out of the presidential race and putting his support behind Kamala Harris, who will likely be the candidate for the Democrats for the presidential election in a few months. And so for me, look, I thought they all said they was riding with Biden. Remember? Riding with Biden, riding with Biden, riding with Biden, riding with Biden. Like they was just repeating that shit out the woo-wah. And they trying, I guess, repeating it, trying to get other people to believe it too. My thoughts and my feelings, you know, I'm indifferent about it all. I mean, like many Americans, I just have a lot of political fatigue. And it shouldn't take this long. Election shouldn't run for like 2 years. When you really pay attention, America be like on a 2 year presidential election cycle. And this shit, it just becomes exhausting and it's difficult to keep up with. And the biggest thing that will always get on my goddamn nerves is I'm just tired of politicians and legislators and talking heads just playing in our faces, right? Like playing in our faces. And what it really boils down for me is, you know, we hear them use fear tactics quite often as trying to motivate us to get up and vote. And it's like, y'all really can't possibly believe that we believe voting is how we get free. Because if that was the case, like shit wouldn't be the way it is now if voting was the way that we got free. If voting was the thing that led to collective liberation from oppression and supremacy, like if voting was the thing that did that, we wouldn't be in these situations that we're in today, and generations would have improved years ago. So we know voting is not the thing that gets us free. And so every time they try to like jam that down our throats, like you gotta vote, you gotta vote, you gotta vote. Okay, like people show up, they vote. And then what? Right? Like change takes so goddamn long when we follow traditional political just kind of tactics. It takes so long for things to change when people's lives need something now. And so if you're telling me that it's important for me to vote today for something that's gonna maybe change 8 years from now, what does that do for me today? Because shit is bad today. Shit was bad yesterday and shit gonna be bad tomorrow and many tomorrows to come. And so, like, when people just say, we got to fight for democracy, fight for democracy, we're losing democracy. I'm always like, did we ever have it? It's like you're trying to convince a collective of people to believe in something that has never worked for them. Democracy has never worked for the oppressed. Democracy has never worked for the minoritized and the marginalized groups of people in this country across all racial demographics, gender, ethnicity, everything. Like, so you try to say we got to protect and serve and save democracy for people who like never had democracy protect and serve them. So what the fuck are y'all talking about? And that always gets me back to the like, stop playing in our faces. And that's each side of this political discourse, every politician, every legislator at all levels, federal, state, local, stop playing in our faces. The moment a lot of these talking heads and politicians and legislators just start keeping shit plain and talking the truth, like you'll never hear me hype up Big T, that orange man. You'll never hear me hype that shit up. But one of the things that man do, he just be saying shit. Like he speaks the truth the way he understands it and the way that people relate to him understand his truth. A lot of other politicians gotta figure that shit out. They have to figure that shit out. And we need more Americans and just everyday folks to stop idealizing politicians like these people are gods and idols and like not immortal. They're not. Hell, in many ways, they're barely people. Like I listen to other podcasts, and I was listening to Van Lathan's podcast episode a couple weeks ago, and it's almost like you have to start to understand, like politicians, yeah, like that person that's in that role is a, they are people. They have lives and families and wishes and dreams and nightmares, goals, all that shit, right? But like the role of a politician, like though that's not a person. They represent ideas, beliefs. Like not they're not people. Like we have to stop looking at politicians as people that we idealize that are like celebrities. They are people, like they are representative of ideas and beliefs. And for some, like possibilities and hope, but like not people. So I don't look at any of these politicians, Kamala included. I don't idealize none of these people. I don't lift them up on pedestals at all. I look at them as people who are in positions to work for me. Like they are literally our employees as the collective of people voting and putting them into these positions of office. If our vote is that powerful, if they're gonna try and convince us that our vote is that powerful and not that like donors, the donors and owning class don't control this shit. Because in many ways they do. They decide who gets in these offices. They decide who runs for political positions. They decide who gets, whatever happens. They make a lot of decisions. Donors in the owning class make a lot of decisions about our lives before we even know it's a decision to be made. They decide shit years in advance before it even gets to us. They know who's going to be running for this office in this district. During which election, they decide all this shit. And so by the time we know about it, that should be too late for real, for real. And I'm not even trying to sound pessimistic because I'm not pessimistic. I'm just a pragmatic and practical person. And so just trying to take in, not just trying, I take in history, I pay attention to what's going on, I listen to generations talk about these things. And so, like, a lot of this shit just be decided by the time it even gets to us. And then they try to use, our shock and awe to galvanize us and make us think it was our idea in the first place. That shit would never be our idea. Be the funniest part of it all is where they flip the game and like feed it back to us. Like that shit don't ever be our idea. And so, like, even paying attention to the assumed excitement across social media and the general media, and about Kamala running for president, I don't know how true that excitement is, because my group chats have been crickets. Like the people that I associate with, the folks that I rock with, like it ain't that type of excitement that them people talk about. I'm one of the 44,000. Cool. I was not. I was not. I was not one of the 44,000 Black women that hopped on that call that's mobilizing and galvanizing support for Kamala Harris. So I don't have the same excitement. And it's not about her. This has little to nothing to do with her and everything to do with just being sick of the establishment playing in my face and in your face too. And I get so sad for people who don't know that these folks are playing in your face and taking your money. They playing in your face and they taking your money. Because why do you need $75 million raised, what was like in one day, to run for the goddamn president of the United States? That shit's fucking nuts. And not just why do you need $75 million? Why are you taking money from everyday folks who are struggling as it is? So, oh, y'all, this country is a joke. This country is funny. It's a funny place. This is a really, really interesting place. But then when I kind of pay attention to it and I use my understanding of just like developmental phases, this country is a teenager, which means it's nutty, it's hormonal, it's indecisive, it's trying to figure out who it is, where it belongs, who is trying to get people to like it, right? Like this country is young as a bitch. It's a hormonal teenager. And all of that is playing out in front of our eyes. Incredibly insecure, lying about his capabilities and skill sets. Like, just this country, this country is a teenager, which also means for somebody like me who is pro young people, gotta have grace for it, right? If I can extend grace to actual teenagers and young people, I'm gonna extend a bit more grace to this country, because it's mine. That's where I live. This is where my family is from. This is what I know. I'm a Black American. You won't hear me talk about that. Oh, you know, I got to get up out of America or I need to go back to Africa. I ain't doing none of that shit. This is my country. This is where I'm from. This is where my culture was created, exists. This is where my culture is exported around the world. This is my shit. I ain't going nowhere. And I can still be honest about how it makes me feel. And I can still share that I don't have the excitement that I'm a, that, you know, my perception that a lot of other just Black women have about this upcoming presidential election. Now, do I understand what's on the line? Absolutely. If I had to pick from two sources of evil, will I pick the one that is lesser? Absolutely. I'm not dumb. I'm pragmatic. But I'm not excited. I'm just tired. I'm just tired of these people playing in my face. Like, I don't see what's going on. Like, we don't see what's going on. And they just need to start being more truthful. And at the end of the day, Joe Biden had no business seeking re-election. A lot of these elders that are holding on to these positions of power, political power, they have no business seeking re-election, knowing they are sick, they are aging, they are unable to fully fulfill their roles. I have never seen people who are like past the general age of retirement, holding on to jobs. That either gives me these, that gives me a couple of kind of signals that holding political office must not be work. Shit must not be labor intensive. It must be pretty easy to do if they're still trying to do it well past retirement age. It also lets me know, well, they have access to a lot of power and they're lining their own pockets with whatever is happening in those roles that they are maintaining. And so that always makes me question, like, why are there so many millionaires in Congress? Why are there so many millionaires in elected positions? That shit is nuts to me. And we just need more folks of the older generation to like, job well done, y'all. You did a great job. It's time for you to go. Like, we should be grooming the next leaders to like step in. This shouldn't be the case of like elected officials that are aging or elderly dying in office. That shit is nuts. What? Because why was you 80 something seeking re-election in the first place for a position or a seat you have held for the last 40 years? What? Like nobody else? There was nobody else that could have done that job. There's nobody else that could have ran that election and won. You gotta be kidding me. And so I just know like there are people of my generation and older, and of course, young folks too, just growing increasingly frustrated with all of it, disillusioned with all of it, not energized about none of it. It's all more of the same shit. It's all more of the same shit. And yeah, like there's gonna be some inconveniences and some discomfort, no matter what administration is in place at every level, federal, national, I mean federal, statewide, local, like it's gonna be discomfort no matter who is in positions of power or who takes on offices or which administrations come in. But at the end of the day, like the majority of us, we just gonna keep living. We live through it all. And so I'm just trying to figure out how to keep living through this. Because then 4 months gonna come and they're gonna go. There's gonna be a new person in office, regardless of anything. And so when that happens, we just figure out, all right, what is the strategy to keep living through this next wave? That's not fair to us by any means, but it's the reality of existing in this moment in time in this country. Whew. All right, so I'm gonna end Earth is Ghetto there, and let's get ready for a tale from the trap. It's been a minute since I told a tale from the trap. All right, so a tale from the trap. And so if you're kind of a newer listener, you don't know about this segment of the podcast, it's when I just kind of recall some lessons I have learned throughout the course of my career as a young OG. And so this tale from the trap has everything to do with a young person. I'm gonna give her the name Lizzie. I'm gonna call Lizzie. So lessons from Lizzie. And so I encountered Lizzie right out of undergrad. So this is 2010 when I got my first job that I mentioned a little earlier in this episode, working in a residential treatment facility for young people ages 13 to 17 years old who were considered at that time severely emotionally disturbed. They were placed there by the foster care systems, by the court systems primarily. I do not recall any parental placements at this particular facility that I worked at. So if I set the scene for you, well, you got 22-year-old Kim, recently relocated back to San Diego from San Jose in California. I'm living back at home. I got this full-time job. So I'm working the split shift. So anybody who's familiar with split work, so I worked 4 10-hour shifts. So like Friday, Saturday, no, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. I worked Friday, Saturday, 8 a.m. No, I worked Thursday, Friday, 8 a.m. and Saturday, Sunday, p.m. shifts. So then I was off Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. And so that is my first full-time job. I'm working at that facility. It is adjacent to a hospital, but not connected to the, or not connected or affiliated with the hospital in any way. The way that you gain access to the facility, there's a gate at the top, but because of, I guess, licensure, it wasn't considered locked. So the gate was always unlocked. However, it was manned by a staff at all times of operation, right? So like that's the way that you have to get buzzed in or keyed in, but you can walk out. Meaning like you couldn't lock the kids into the facility. They can literally open up that gate and walk out, even though there would always be a staff up there. So I'm trying to paint the scenes so I can kind of see the way this facility looked. It was like a campus style, but it had Like a cafeteria building, a schoolhouse building. It had three dormitories, one for female identified young people, male identified young people, and then a co-ed unit. It had green space, and it also had basketball courts and like another outdoor space for young people, just to kind of be for like rec purposes. I worked on the co-ed unit all throughout my tenure at this facility. And so the way our co-ed unit was set up, some of the young people shared rooms, some because of issues had single rooms. But you had like the girls on one half, and there was like a split, and then the boys would be on the other half. You had, of course, your nurses station where the staff would be. You had the rec area for young people. There was a group room, and then there was like the back room where the staff was, but also what was considered the PSR, so the protective separation room, which is where you would take young people if you had to restrain them or if there was an incident on the unit, or like some young people would just request to go to the PSR because they just wanted some time to themselves, wanted to de-escalate, they wanted to get away from their roommate, they just wanted to just go to the PSR and kick it. So, lessons from Lizzie. Let me get back to Lizzie. Lizzie is one of the young people who comes on to the unit, and I remember the stories about her before she even got there. I remember reading her chart before even meeting her, and people were just trying to instill like, oh, this one about to be a problem. Like she didn't got sent from this facility to this place and this many foster care placements, and she fights and she runs and she engages in self-harm and she's combative and aggressive towards staff, all this type of shit, right? Y'all, this baby showed up. The sweetest thing, if I'm not mistaken, she had to be maybe 13. She was like one of the youngest people. She might have been 12 going on 13, if I'm not mistaken, honestly. She showed up, and I remember she gave them people hell when she got there. And notice I say them people, meaning like other staff. She gave staff hell when she got there, but a lot of it was her adjusting to a new environment, her also working through a much of the trauma that she experienced in her young life, her trying to prove herself, figure out where she belonged on the totem pole of the unit. But she gave them people hell, like destroying the unit, destroying her room, throwing shit. But I ain't never had no issues with Lizzie. I ain't never had no issues with her. What that baby taught me was patience. Like she taught young Kim patience. She taught young Kim how to play and slow down. She taught me deep understanding and compassion. She also taught me just how much evil exists in this world. I was young and I was naive early in my career. I knew that like bad stuff happened to people, that bad things happen to kids. I had no idea just how bad, just how evil people were. I'm not going to go into the details of her case and the things that she experienced. Just know it's the type of shit where all these years later, I'll never forget how much evil is still in this world. Now, I believe there's way more good here than evil, but listening to like Lizzie tell me stories firsthand of things that happened to her that like the documentation and her chart would never kind of match up the detail through which she explained and the horrors of which she survived and lived in her very young life. And what I did not know at the time that I have grown to know is I had something in me that allowed her to feel seen and safe enough. But she trusts me, which, is not easy for young people that have experienced severe abuse and neglect that are, in the foster care system. But she trusts me enough. She also liked me, meaning like she would tell me jokes and I would be able to joke back with her. I would also be able to give her direction to like clean up, do her hygiene, go to school, like stop messing with them people. Like, girl, calm down. So she liked me enough to be able to be playful with me. I was able to be playful back with her. I was able to slow down. I will never forget some of my favorite moments with her. Well, she could not sleep. She had horrible nightmares because of her trauma. So, and because I work night shifts, she would not sleep. And I was one of the rare staff that would, sit on the floor in her doorway with her and color. And so we would color on the floor. Sometimes we wouldn't talk at all. Many times we wouldn't talk at all. She wouldn't talk. We would just color and play card games quietly. There would be times because of, her self harming behaviors, she would ask me like, "Hey, Kim, hold my hands." And so like I would hold her hands to help, regulate her system to then get her to move through just the thoughts of wanting to engage in self-harm, but like give her something else to do. She would kind of viciously scratch at her arms with her nails to try to, break skin, to bleed, to have a sensation. And I remember like the times when she would get agitated with other staff or triggered by other young people. And I'll be able to step in and be like, "Hey, Lizzie, give me your hands." Right. Like she would trusting and give me her hands. And we would just kind of hold hands. And I had no idea what I was doing. I'm not trained. I'm nobody's therapist, clinician. I'm not a social worker at this time. I'm just somebody trying to figure out like what's going to work. Remember, fresh out of undergrad with a degree in behavioral science and so sociology. What do you do with that? So I didn't get any training when I got to this facility. I just kind of knew like, hey, touch regulates. Maybe if I offer her the opportunity to touch because she trusts me that she'll take it. And so like that became her thing. And it also became a thing I was able to kind of model unknowingly for like other staff. But these lessons from Lizzie, I have held on to since 2010, so 14 years, because this baby taught me that although there is evil in this world, the good outweighs it, and the evil can't be the thing that gets our attention or prevents us from living. I had never seen somebody go through the things that she has gone through, yet still had the ability to laugh, find joy, want to play, like fight to reclaim her childhood as much as possible and to bear witness to that at a young age, to be invited into that at a young age. Like I'll never take that for granted. And now me, bigger Kim, reflecting on that, it's like, yo, I have a thing that allows me to be allowed into other people's lives. And I cannot abuse that. I don't take it lightly. And even though I jokingly be talking about I want to scam so bad because like that shit is be looking fun, and I know I would be good at it, but it's this idea of, girl, you can't be doing no shit like that because you have a gift to disarm and welcome and be invited into people's lives. How dare you use that for evil? So that's the primary reason I don't scam, even though if I wanted to and I could turn off my integrity and my care and my love for people, I'd be a phenomenal scammer and cult leader. I just know that's not in my spirit or in my heart. And so like these lessons from Lizzie and just the other young people and families I have been trusted to be a part of their world and their lives, they teach me so much about me, about life, makes me question, right? Like my own understanding of the world and people. And I am always so grateful to never be the only expert in a space. Like I can see the lessons and expertise from anyone and everyone that I am in a space with, regardless of academic background, upbringing, experience, any of that. I saw the wisdom and the lessons that were available to me from a 13-year-old when I was 22 years old, and I took them. And to this day, I still hold on to them. And so that's my tales from the trap for the week. Let's go ahead and move into a good Black word. All right, good Black word for the week. So I want to talk about looking versus living. So, I've had my homie on the podcast a couple of times, well, twice. So Mecca Williams, if you're not familiar with her, like I would encourage y'all to go out and, go back and check those two episodes that we previously recorded together. But me and Mecca, we talk all the time about many things, but what I really enjoy talking to Mecca about is like life and theories and philosophies and thoughts and like all that shit. Like being able to go deeper with somebody is necessary for me. And so yesterday we were talking about the things that we talk about, and it's kind of this has stuck with me since then. Mecca had made the comment of like, people are just around here looking, like we all just looking, right? And I was like, yeah, like you got a lot of people looking and not living. And that has resonated with me because I have been in the mind of doing way more living than looking, but I cannot ignore how many people are stuck looking at people live life. And I wonder if that's some of y'all, right? Like just stuck at looking at people live life and not participating in life, not living your own life, which you're fully worthy and deserving of. And so it really makes me question how many of us are looking and not living. And what would it take for us to do a bit less looking and a lot more living? And what is getting in the way of the living? And if the looking is right, so looking can also lead to doubts and anxieties and insecurities and comparisons, which can cripple. I don't want to use that word. That is not supportive of those with different abilities. Let me take that back. The looking could prevent, there we go, prevent many of us from living the life that's necessary for us because we don't believe either we're worthy of it or we can't do it as good as somebody else. But who's to say they're doing it good in the first place? And even like their good is not your good. You got your own good, right? Like you got your own things that make you who you are, that you have your own stuff that makes you tick, that makes you feel joy and love and care and warmth. And you have your own stuff. And so, at what point do we just kind of stop looking at how other people are living and just live the way we want to live? And I know that's a type of freedom and liberation that a lot of people are afraid to work towards, but I believe it's what's required of us. It's what belongs to us is to be able to get to that type of freedom and liberation where we're living the life that's for us, the one we deserve, the one that we want. The one that we co-create with all the other elements and lives and energies that are here with us. But I really just want to encourage people, all of y'all, to do a little less looking and way more living. You deserve that. It's the least you can offer yourself in some of these shittiest times that we are experiencing together. And if any time, is a time to do a little less looking at the news, at social media apps, at the bullshit. It's now. Less looking, more living, and see how that works out for you. So that's all I got for the week, y'all. Thank you so much for rocking with me. Thank you so much for holding me down for this year of revolutionary hood rap. Where we go from here, I don't know, but we going together. And I also hope that y'all are going or planning to pull up on me and Marvin and Joy at the We Off Community and Hood Rat Joy brunch in Philadelphia on September 7, 2014 at Rec Philly. You can visit weoffbrunch.com to purchase a ticket or learn more. It's gonna be a good time. It really is. It really is. And as I kind of mentioned before, if you've been, looking for to make a move and find your people, build a village, and just, want to be able to go somewhere by yourself, this is the perfect place to come. If you have nobody that want to go with you, come alone. You won't be alone when you get there. But don't just look. right? Like, don't let this brunch pass by. You looked at it happen online and you didn't decide to tap into living to come be a part of it. And so I hope y'all decide to pull up on us at brunch on September 7th in Philadelphia at Rec Philly. I'm excited to be with as many of the cousins as possible in flesh, in person. I look forward to exchanging energies and vibes with y'all and being awkward, because that's all I have to offer you at the end of the day, anyways. So I'm gonna leave it there. I'm grateful. I'm grateful. I'm grateful. I'm honored. That I have been invited into many of your lives, and I hope that I am not disappointing you. Y'all be well. And until next time, y'all remember to take care of your heart so that we can take care of each other, and we shall chat soon.